Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Mario Ritter Jr. and Steve Ember. But first, this report from Ann Ball.
The powerful ocean storm that struck the Bahamas earlier this month killed more than 50 people and destroyed many homes, businesses, and school buildings. Now, Bahamian education officials are trying to find classroom space for students whose families have been displaced. Hurricane Dorian was one of the most powerful storms in the country's recorded history. It made landfall on September 1st and remained on top of the northern Bahamas for almost 50 hours. It damaged or destroyed nearly every structure on the island of Great Abaco. The nearby Grand Bahama Island was hit hard, too. Bahamian officials say they hope fewer than 10,000 students would need to be placed into new schools. The plan is to move them to schools across the islands. Officials recently set up what they describe as a one-stop shop for the displaced students. Last Thursday, those students gathered inside the Thomas A. Robinson National Stadium in Nassau, the Bahamian capital. The students, aged 4 to 19, waited in line for clothing, school supplies, shots, and vision and hearing tests. They also sought appointments to speak with volunteer mental health workers. These kids need their education. How are they going to get jobs or have any options? Said Chandra Alexis, an 18-year-old evacuee from Abaco, about 150 kilometers north of Nassau. We lost everything. Without school, there's nothing, she said. She was waiting in line to find out which schools her younger sister and another family member would attend this year. The island of Abaco had 17 schools, most of them public. Grand Bahama had about 20 schools, said Belinda Wilson. She is president of Bahamas Union of Teachers. She said all of the union's members on the two islands were found safe. Public schools on most islands opened on September 9th, a week later than the planned opening. But on Abaco and Grand Bahama, schools remained closed. Engineers have had to check the safety of the school buildings. Wilson and the teachers' union say that no teacher or student is going to enter any of those buildings until an engineer is able to say that those schools are structurally sound. Lorraine Armbruster is permanent secretary of the Bahamas Ministry of Education. She said the main goal right now is to get children back into school so that they're not further disadvantaged or further traumatized. She said, we want to normalize their lives as soon as possible. The government is registering evacuees living in temporary shelters in the capital. Soon, it will work with those staying in Nassau hotels or with family and friends to get their children into schools. Nassau is on New Providence Island. Wilson said that island's schools may not have enough room for all of the displaced children who were evacuated to the capital. There are many other islands that could accommodate students, said Wilson, whose union represents about 4,000 teachers on 24 islands. She added that the process of moving teachers, students, and parents to different islands will take all of our imagination. The United Nations Children's Fund is working with the Bahamian Education Ministry. It said student signups would begin on other islands in the coming days. I'm Ann Ball.
During months of negotiations, the Afghan Taliban promised the United States that it would never again be attacked from Afghan soil. Such a promise would have included Al-Qaeda. 18 years ago, Al-Qaeda's leadership planned attacks on the U.S. mainland from inside Afghanistan, which was controlled at the time by the Taliban. The attacks were carried out on September 11, 2001. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda are linked together by their shared history and desire for jihad, or holy war. And there is no evidence that the two groups have broken off relations. Earlier, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the Taliban had agreed to cut ties with Al-Qaeda as part of peace negotiations. President Donald Trump broke off the negotiations last week after a suicide bombing in Kabul killed 11 people. One of those killed belonged to the U.S. Armed Forces. The Al-Qaeda leadership still vows loyalty to Taliban chief Maulvi Haibatullah Akhundzada. Experts say that the group has overcome setbacks such as the establishment of an Islamic State group affiliate in eastern Afghanistan. The militants also have set up a group called Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent, which has influence as far as Myanmar. Asfandiar Mir is with the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. Mir says that Al-Qaeda has recovered recently and its ties with the Taliban remain strong. There is no discernible evidence of a break or disjuncture between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, he told the Associated Press. Instead, at least parts of the Afghan Taliban, such as the Haqqani Network and Al-Qaeda, continue to actively collaborate, he added. In the 1980s, U.S. officials were among those who urged Arab fighters to travel to Afghanistan to fight with the Afghan Mujahideen, or Holy Warriors.
They were allied in an effort to oust the Soviet Union, which entered Afghanistan in late 1979. Saudi Arabia's government helped finance that holy war. Today, many former members of the Mujahideen force make up the Taliban leadership. Others are part of the U.S.-supported Afghan government. As the war against the Soviet occupation came to a close in 1988, many Arab fighters came together to follow a rich Saudi leader named Osama bin Laden. They created the militant group Al-Qaeda. Later, the group would seek to fight the U.S. government. Afghanistan has suffered through years of fighting. The Taliban movement came to power in 1996 and ruled the country until it was ousted by the U.S.-led coalition in 2001. 18 years of fighting have left the Taliban and its allies in control of, or influential in, half the country. That is its strongest position since the U.S.-led action in 2001 forced the group from power. A U.S. government report suggests that the number of Al-Qaeda militants has also grown in recent years. Allied groups such as the Pakistani Taliban, who hid in Afghanistan to escape the Pakistani military, are also gaining strength. And Afghanistan still has many foreign fighters. A United Nations Security Council report from July said that the largest concentrations of active foreign terrorist fighters are in Syria and Afghanistan. Most are linked to Al-Qaeda. Some members of the Taliban have tried to distance themselves from Al-Qaeda. But reports say Al-Qaeda remains allied to the Taliban's leadership and its Haqqani network. The Afghanistan expert, Asfandiar Mir, said that in places that the group controls, the Taliban appoints governors who have ties to Al-Qaeda. So it is unclear how the Taliban could guarantee that Afghanistan would not become a safe place for terrorists after a peace deal is signed. U.S. Peace Representative Zalmay Khalilzad has yet to discuss details of his negotiations. It remains unclear if the Taliban provided any information on where Al-Qaeda leaders are hiding, including bin Laden's replacement, Ayman al-Zawahiri. Bill Roggio is a terrorism expert and main editor for the Long War Journal, published by the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington, D.C. He said that al-Zawahiri and al-Qaeda's media group, As-Sahab, remain in operation and likely are based in Pakistan or Afghanistan. Mir said Al-Qaeda's media group creates propaganda aimed at Afghans and Pakistanis. Roggio said the group has expanded to operate in many areas, I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They planned to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, the leaders wrote a completely new constitution. It created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. Last week, we told how the group reached agreement on the position and powers of a national executive. They decided the executive could veto laws, and they decided the person could be removed from office if found guilty of serious crimes. We also told about the debate on a national judiciary. The delegates approved a federal system of courts and judges. These courts would hear cases involving national laws, the rights of American citizens, and wrongdoing by foreign citizens in the country. State courts would continue to hear cases involving state laws. Next, the delegates began to discuss competing proposals for a national legislature. This would be the most hotly debated issue of the convention. It forced the question of equal representation. Would small states and large states have an equal voice in the central government? The convention had already agreed that the national legislature would have two houses. It had not agreed, however, on the number of representatives each state would have in each house. The large states wanted representation based on population, but the small states believed they would lose power to the large states. They wanted representation to be the same for all states, no matter what the size. One day, Gunning Bedford of Delaware, one of the smallest states, looked straight at the delegates from the largest states. "Gentlemen," he shouted, "I do not trust you. If you try to crush the small states, you will destroy the Confederation. And if you do, the small states will find some foreign ally of more honor and good faith who will take them by the hand and give them justice." The debate on legislative representation, big states against small states, lasted for weeks that summer in Philadelphia. The delegates could not agree, so they debated other parts of the proposal. One involved the names of the two houses of the legislature. Most spoke of them simply as the first branch and the second branch. We will speak of them by the names used today, the House of Representatives and the Senate. Next came the question, who could be elected to the House and Senate? Delegates did not take long to decide. Members of the House, they agreed, must be at least 25 years old. They must have been citizens of the United States for 7 years. And at the time of election, they must live in the state in which they are chosen. The delegates agreed that members of the Senate must be at least 30 years old. They also must have been a citizen of the United States for 9 years. And at the time of election, they too must live in the state in which they are chosen. But who would elect them? The question raised an interesting issue. It concerned democracy. In 1787, the word democracy meant something very different from what it means today. To many of the men meeting in Philadelphia, democracy meant mob rule. To give power to the people was an invitation to anarchy. Still, George Mason of Virginia argued for popular elections. The people will be represented, Mason said, so they should choose their representatives. James Wilson of Pennsylvania agreed. He stated firmly that the people must elect at least one branch of the national legislature. That, he said, was a basic condition for free government. The majority of the convention agreed with Mason. The delegates decided that members of the House of Representatives should be elected directly by the people. Akil Reed Amar is a professor at Yale Law School in Connecticut. He says the delegates' decision to let people elect their representatives helped change the meaning of the word democracy.
The success of the American Constitutional Project has proved to the rest of the world that democracy can work, government of, by, and for the people can survive and flourish, and this has been a model for the rest of the world.
However, most delegates agreed that the state legislatures would choose the representatives to the second legislative branch, the Senate. It remained that way for more than 100 years. In 1913, the states approved the 17th Amendment to the Constitution. This amendment legalized the direct election of senators by the people. How long would lawmakers serve? Roger Sherman of Connecticut thought representatives to the House should be elected every year. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts agreed. He thought a longer term would lead to a dictatorship. James Madison of Virginia protested. It will take almost 1 year, he said, just for lawmakers to travel to and from the seat of government. Madison proposed a 3-year term, but the delegates finally agreed on 2 years. There were many ideas about the term for senators. A few delegates thought they should be elected for life. In the end, the convention agreed on a Senate term of 6 years. Next came a debate about the pay for elected officials. How much should they get? Or should they be paid at all? Some delegates thought the states should pay their representatives to the national legislature. Others said the national legislature should decide its own pay and take it from the national treasury. That idea, James Madison argued, was shameful. He thought the amount should be set by the Constitution. Again, Madison lost the argument. The Constitution states only that lawmakers will be paid for their services and that the money will come from the national treasury. Finally, the time came for the convention to face the issue of representation in the House and Senate. The large states still wanted representation based on population, and the small states still wanted equal representation. The delegates had voted on the issue several times since the convention began. But both sides stood firm. Yet they knew they could not continue to vote forever, day after day. So the delegates did what large groups often do when they cannot reach agreement. they voted to create a committee. This grand committee would try to develop a compromise. The rest of the delegates would enjoy themselves during the July 4th holiday marking American independence. July 4th, Independence Day. It marked the 11th anniversary of America's Declaration of Independence from British rule. The celebration was especially important in Philadelphia. It was the city where the Declaration of Independence was signed. Now it was the city where a new nation was being created. Convention President George Washington led a group of delegates to a ceremony at a Philadelphia church. They heard a speech written especially for them. "Your country looks to you with both worry and hope," the speaker said. "Your country depends on your decisions. Your country believes that men such as you, who led us in our war for independence, will know how to plan a government that will be good for all Americans. Surely we have the ability to design a government that will protect the liberties we have won." After the speech, Benjamin Franklin urged the convention to ask for God's help. He said each meeting should begin with a prayer. Hugh Williamson of North Carolina quickly ended any discussion of Franklin's idea. The convention, he said, had no money to pay a minister to lead the delegates in prayer. On July 5th, the Grand Committee presented a two-part compromise. It provided something for large states and something for small states. It called for representation based on population in the House and for equal representation in the Senate. The committee said both parts of the compromise must be accepted or both rejected. Delegates debated the compromise for many days. They knew if they did not reach agreement, the convention would fail. Those were dark days in Philadelphia. Later, Luther Martin of Maryland noted that the newspapers reported on how much the delegates agreed. But that was not the truth. "We were on the edge of breaking up," Martin said. "We were held together only by the strength of a hair." Delegates Robert Yates and John Lansing of New York had left the convention in protest. But George Mason of Virginia declared he would bury his bones in Philadelphia before he would leave without an agreement. Even General George Washington was depressed. He wrote to Alexander Hamilton, who had returned to New York temporarily. "I am sorry you went away," Washington said. "Our discussions are now, if possible, worse than ever. There is little agreement on which a good government can be formed. I have lost almost all hope of seeing a successful end to the convention, and so I regret that I agreed to take part." On July 16th, the convention voted on the issue for the last time. It accepted what is called the Great Compromise. But even this agreement raised another problem. If representation was based on population, who would you count? Would you count just free people? Or would you count Negro slaves too?
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.